Call this meeting of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners to order. This is Wednesday, November 1st, a new month, and we are here in the Commissioner's Room in the Lincoln County Courthouse. The first item on the agenda is to establish a quorum. Commissioner Thompson is attending the Ocean Policy Advisory Council meeting, so wish him well there. I know he's advocating ocean issues. We do have a quorum. And next is recognition and proclamations. We have two. Neither of the individuals are here. But for the record, we would recognize David Bradshaw of the Clerk's Office for 10 years of service to the county, and Andrew Ferguson in the Juvenile Department also for 10 years of service. We have pins, we have certificates, and we will see that they get delivered to them in recognition and appreciation of their service to the county. We also expect some new employees will be attending with Bridget or Dell from the HR department. When they show up, we'll give them an opportunity to introduce themselves. So we'll move on to adoption of the consent calendar. These are items of a routine nature or items that have been before the board previously. If there's anything that you wish to highlight, now would be a time. Otherwise, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll just highlight the fact that we've got a lot of contracts, mostly updates of existing contracts, and sometimes if people wonder what our lawyers do, that Mr. Bellin, what did you say? Can you give us any even ballpark idea? I know you don't track your hours like private lawyers do, but it's a considerably time-consuming thing because there's one line here, but often these are contracts that are thick volumes.
And there's a combination of things that we do. Sometimes we actually create the contracts for the departments or for offices. Sometimes we review the contracts, and oftentimes what we do is negotiate back and forth to get the contracts together. So there's hundreds of these things. I was looking at Janet Harrison, who's our paralegal here, for what we do on an annual basis, but it's an incredible number of agreements that run through the county system.
And I just thought it might be interesting to highlight that for a change, because it's something we usually approve pretty routinely, but you know, protecting the county's interests, making sure that we get the resources that are promised, is part of doing business as the large organization we are.
Correct.
With those observations, I would be happy to make a motion for approval of the consent calendar.
And I'll second it. Before I call for a vote, I think it's interesting to note that we have over two pages of items on the consent calendar, and this isn't ordinarily a time of year when you might expect a large volume. You know, if it's the end of the fiscal year or the end of the calendar year, maybe, but you know, it's the 1st of November, so interesting observation of the volume of work. So with that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And motion carries. Next item, we have two public hearings. The first one is on ordinance number 499. This is in the matter of initiating amendments to the Lincoln County Comprehensive Plan and Land Use Code to update farm and forest provisions of Chapter 1 of the Lincoln County Code. And our presenters are County Council Herbage and Planning Director Husey. And this is a public hearing. For the record, first of all, let me read the ordinance. The ordinance number 499, amending the agricultural conservation zone and timber conservation zone and the section of the LCC regarding standards and procedures governing conditional uses. The Board of Commissioners initiated this legislative process by adopting Resolution 17-22-3B to initiate a code amendment process for farm and forest lands and conditional uses in Lincoln County. This process was assisted by funding from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The Planning Commission held a public hearing on September 25th, 2017, and a recommended adoption of the amendments as proposed. This is the public hearing set before the Board of Commissioners to consider the Planning Commission's recommendations and to adopt Ordinance Number 499, amending the LCC, making the Planning Commission's recommendations recommended changes to the LCC. The procedures as follow. I'll open the hearing. We'll have a staff report. The board will receive comments, testimony from the audience. We'll close the hearing. Then we'll have deliberation and decide what we wish to do from there. If you're going to comment or testify today, we ask that you come forward to the table. Give us your name and address for the record, and that you hand any materials over to our recorder, Christy Whitaker. And with that, I will ask Council Belmont to discuss the record and for refusing to give the staff report and open a public hearing.
And Commissioners, actually, County Council Herbert is going to give the report. So
I did acknowledge that originally.
You did. I'll do it. I'll take care of it.
And I was trying to be so creative because it says ask Council, and I just... defaulted to Mr. Belmont.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Jerry Herbage, and I am an assistant county counsel working on the farm and forest zones. And what I'd like to say from the outset, and Planning Director Arnold Husing will go over this, is that this is a somewhat routine matter. In that, what you will be doing, you'll be asked to approve amendments to the Chapter 1 of Lincoln County Code that are mandated in law, that exist otherwise generally in the administrative regulations and the statutes. And what's unique about planning is that we have our own procedure. So under ORS Chapter 215, in fact it's 215-223, the law requires us to publish notice of the ordinance, which is somewhat different than the run-of-the-mill ordinances. So you have to publish notice at least 10 days before the hearing. And so I have a copy of the published notice, and actually it shows that it was done more than 10 days in advance. It has the notice both for this ordinance and for the one on the sands of Bayshore that will be coming up briefly. So I'd like to hand this to Ms. Christy Whitaker as part of the record. And
thank you.
In addition, I would like for the board to affirm, I guess, that the file number 01-TA-17 is made part of the record. That's the packet that you have.
All right.
That. Looks like that's been done by consensus.
Yes.
If there are any questions about the legal aspect, well, before we get there, what I would like for the board to do is to affirm that we can read by title only, because this is a first hearing.
I have no desire to have the ordinance read in its entirety.
And I affirm that as well.
Okay. So, should I go ahead and read that title? Okay. Relating to Land Use Planning, Amending LCC 1.1373, Agricultural Conservation Zone, and then it says AC, and then LCC 1.1375, that's the Timber Conservation Zone, T-C, and LCC 1.1630, and standards and procedures governing conditional uses and declaring an emergency. Thank you. I'm done with the procedural matters unless there are any additional questions.
I guess I would clarify. Are we declaring an emergency on this ordinance also?
Yes, we can do this for the planning ordinances. It's a little bit different procedure for adoption of those. And we can go ahead and, if you so desire, at the end of the hearing, depending on what you hear in the hearing, you can adopt these particular ordinances and have that declared immediately effective.
Yeah. So could I go over that real quick?
Sure.
Well, I'd reference 215-223. It's a little bit different language than Chapter 203, where you ordinarily adopt ordinances. And what 215-223 tells us, and I have it in front of me, is that you can't approve this unless you have, it says, one or more public hearings. So what's interesting is one suffices, and I know some other jurisdictions don't even bother with the emergency part, but you know, one or more, and then publish. And so I can tell you very clearly that Lincoln County has complied with its obligations in the publications, and you have the one hearing.
Okay, very good. Anything from Director Hughes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Hall, pleased to be here today to walk you through these changes, but I promise you I will not walk you through every little nook and cranny of this sprawling changes in our land use code. Let me provide for you a quick explanation of how this came about. There's a memo to you that explains this, but especially for the public too. Amending our land use code is not a minor matter, because at our planning department, it can have a tremendous impact on property owners in Lincoln County. So, of course, that's one of the reasons we have such an elaborate public process, because it's not a minor matter to amend our code. And interesting, like when I came to the planning department 5.5 years ago, we were one of those departments that just didn't sort of constantly monkey with our land use code. That it was finely honed. It's been, by and large, a really nice, tight, compact code. I understand some jurisdictions have these, over time they've done so many incremental changes to their code that it's like a foot high and nobody can use it. But we've been pretty disciplined about how when we do code amendments in the past, and I have a growing respect for doing that, because we're not constantly moving the cheese on people, and when we do a code amendment, it really needs to be thoughtful. However, as I'm sure the two of you know, we are carrying out our Lincoln County Development Code. Really, its source of authority comes from the state legislature through Senate Bill 100, which is the land use planning law. And so much of Oregon's land use planning law is really found in administrative rules, which have the force of law, but they're in turn anchored to the fundamental statute that authorizes the state to conduct statewide land use planning. So our code reflects the planning, zoning, and what you can or can't do in all these zones outside of the incorporated city. It's the unincorporated areas of Lincoln County that this pertains to. So as a practical matter, though, the state, from time to time, every time the legislature meets, and certainly the Land Conservation and Development, when they promulgate administrative rules, we have an obligation to make sure that, and we get some help from the Department of Land Conservation and Development to alert us that, hey, by the way, these are some different things that are going on here, and that really we have a duty to align our code to make sure that it's aligned with any changes that are happening statutorily and with administrative rules that come out. And so it was already a year or two ago, I learned that there was an opportunity that the Department of Land Conservation and Development was offering voluntarily, sort of a grant program. We didn't get any money, but we got the services of a consulting group to help us, and it was very helpful, go through our farm and our agricultural lands and our timber lands, only those, but that's a substantial amount of property in Lincoln County. That's not a minor matter. But what the entire exercise is about is the Angelo Planning Group, working closely with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, were tasked to work with our staff and our county councils to go through what our, and they examined our code and helped flag for us things that we needed to do to amend our code, again, to be aligned with existing state law and state administrative rules, which have the effect of state law. Now, when we did this, there was an opportunity as well that in this process, and a number of jurisdictions have done this because they have the same obligations that we do. So we weren't the first guinea pigs coming out of the chute with this thing. It was nice to allow other jurisdictions to go forward, and it was reported there was a constructive process. There weren't any landmines built into this thing. It was a straight up deal. So with that knowledge in mind, knowing that we have this obligation to align our code, we took advantage of the process, and of course we got your permission to do that back in the day. So here we find ourselves now with a package of code amendments, but let me stress one thing. When we started working with the state and the consulting group with this, in addition to stuff in the code that we were obligated to be aligned with, there were some discretionary aspects that said, well, what about this and what about that? And when we combed through that at a staff level, there were some pretty good ideas in there, but we parked all of those on the side of the road. So what you have before you today is just a clean, mandatory changes only, not the discretionary stuff. I thought that was very important to have this exercise. I mean, if there were some good ideas that can be discussed later, that's fine. But it was really, I think it was important to discipline this process by only looking at the things that we really needed to align. So when we went in front of the Planning Commission, that they, as you know in your memo, we had the same discussion about what's this all about, what does this really do? And I'll remember the Planning Commission looked at us and said, at the end of it, because I was explaining to them, look, if there is something in the administrative rules or the statute that currently isn't in our code, we're already obligated to apply that. And so what we've ended up doing is, if we're aware our existing code, because it's currently not aligned, like most codes that out there, and they need to catch up to become aligned, we're aware of many of these administrative rules. And so what we've been doing is, like others, when we know there's an administrative rule out there which is something different than in our code, we're applying it. But the exercise in terms of transparency and being helpful for the public is to consolidate all of this into one document. So when people look at our code, they're not thinking, especially if they don't come into the planning department, they're sort of, you know, trying to work with our code to understand what they can or can't do. They could easily miss, of course, this other administrative rule out there that has a direct bearing on what they want to do. Now, if they come to talk to us and we're aware of those other administrative codes, we can make sure everything's aligned. But it is good government to make sure that our code, so the public in particular, and so that we don't make mistakes. We don't have to remember, oh, that's right, there's another OAR out there that we have to grab and apply here. So I think this, again, is an outstanding exercise. We have tremendous help from Jerry here to make sure that all the nuances of getting aligned were. But just as a closing thought here, and I can give you an example or two if you'd like about how our one or two of these code amendments, just to give you a flavor for what that's like. But when we're in front of the Planning Commission, when they heard the same explanation, they sort of looked at me and said, well, there's not a lot to talk about then, is there? And I said, no, there really isn't. Now, normally most code amendments have a really important policy dimension to them, where we're deciding to allow something to happen or not to happen, and so we would be having a vigorous policy discussion, in a sense, just like we're about to on a different code amendment. But these are, in effect, mandatory. So my last note would be, okay, let's say we chose not to adopt these. It would be business as usual. We're still applying. We're not changing the law here. The law has already been changed. We're merely making sure, from a housekeeping perspective, that our code has everything, so it's all in one place, so that we don't make mistakes and that the public is not going to sort of find out after the fact that, wait a minute, there's some stray OAR out there that they didn't know about, because it's not built in. It's not even cross-referenced in here. So again, I think this is one of these few times where I don't expect us to have a lot of dialogue. Of course, we would be pleased to entertain any questions and commentaries from you, and I can give you some examples of how the code changed. I'll leave it up to you for what you prefer, how you want to proceed here at this, because that could be the end of my staff report, but I could give you a flavor for one or two changes if you'd like.
Could I ask a couple of questions?
Of course.
It all seems pretty self-evident, but one question, you know, the overall question, you're saying in effect, this is technical, it's not changing the way we do business at all. So fair to say, there's a pretty high bar generally for building or any kind of development on farm and forest land right now. And this is not going to make it, just to put what you said in in different terms. This is not going to make it any harder or any easier to do development on agriculture and forest lands, correct?
And I can say yes with a great sense of certainty and a categorical yes, because we're obligated to apply those elements anyway.
Exactly. That's what
and
I
And it's rare that you're getting that such a simple answer from me.
Yep, but I thought in this case we could, too, for the public's sake. Have there been any incidents that you're aware of where the public comes in and wants to do something and it's been a case of, well, the code says we can do it, or the code doesn't say anything about it, and then you have to pull out and say, oh, gee, sorry, there's an OAR that says you can't do that, just as an example? Has it caused much confusion up till now? I mean, even if that hasn't happened, I still think in the interests of transparency and making sure we're aligned with state laws and OARs, it's a good thing to do.
But you know, frankly, no.
Okay.
And I think that's because, and I think I don't want to discourage our members of the public to not look at our code and play planner and do all this themselves. It is so much easier to come in and talk with us, and we work with the code together. And we really have a dialogue about what they want to try to do and to see how to get there, and if they can't get there, what can they do? I mean, that is the mother's milk of what we do and the central engagement we have with the public all the time. So, again, I don't want to discourage people from looking at the code and then thinking they've got it all figured out. Please contact us. It really makes it's a lot easier. You don't have to hunt and peck in there and try to find things. Now, Commissioner Hall, I like the question because it's sort of the fact that that doesn't happen that often, and people have become accustomed to coming in and talking to us, it's so much simpler and so much more accurate to make sure that we have that kind of dialogue and really look at things. So I want to make, I don't think a lot of people sort of turn around and go into the code. And that's why we don't have that many examples where someone comes in with a full-blown application and then we're having to say, oh, wait a minute, there's an administrative rule. The one time, interestingly, where it did come up was when we created a new element in our code for a park master plan. And that was a case where state parks, with the Brian Booth process, which is still underway, we're hopefully ironing out the last details to come forward to our planning commission for a recommendation on that. But that was a case of the applicant more or less saying, wait a minute, your code is old.
Right.
It has real limitations on what we can do. There are these administrative rules out here, both at the Department of Land Conservation and Oregon State Parks, that, you know, we could assert.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't amend your code to provide for the parks master and planning thing, not that they wanted to be confrontational about this, but it was a courtesy conversation. But I certainly said to myself, ouch, wow, it had never come up here because parks don't happen every day. Brand new parks where you would have to apply these administrative
especially rules. At that scale.
So a lot of times things won't come up, especially if they're rather rare events. You're not going to bump into that issue. You know, the one example I do want to share, because I think it's really instructive, and it's quick. 4 or 5 years ago when I came on board, one of our planners, Stu Cowie, who's no longer works at our planning department, though, he noticed that under our farm code, that to be able to live on the property to participate in true farm activity, agriculture, you had to be a blood relative or an in-law. And he looked at me and he said, Anno, I think that's bad policy. Because who cares if you're the brother-in-law, if you're there actually, you know, if you're a blood relative or not, if you're the person who's committed to live on the this farm and take care of the animals and do all these things, which is really necessary, there need to be people out there to do it. You can't phone in real farming. Maybe grass seed grows on some, but taking care of animals, right? These people are like locked in there to these places. They need help. So Stuart looked at this and said to me, he says, I really don't think that's good policy. He looked at our code, and he said, I don't think that's good policy. And I said, well, call up the state and start a conversation about the policy. And when he did, we found out that they had amended their OAR to allow for that. So we were missing out.
Uh-huh.
That was an example. Now, and guess what? That's built in here.
Yeah.
So it isn't always breaking against us. Your quest, that's what I think is another important nuance. Just because there's a code amendment coming down from the state doesn't mean it's more restrictive. It might actually be liberalized what you can do in a way that makes sense. So let's not instantly think that if the state's done something, that it's out to encumber property owners being able to make a living and being on their land. And so I just use that as an example of something that we did discover, ironically, just because we called in and realized, my God, they'd already done that. And then we started applying it, of course, because we knew about it.
Sure.
Thank you. So that's one anecdote of, well, two actually, then that sort of puts some meat on the bone of how this thing operates in the real world.
Okay. So as I sense it, this is really mandatory changes that have been in place from a practice standpoint. The planning department's been aware of these changes. So we're really just aligning the language, if you will, of our ordinance to align with the state. And it's really not changing the way we do business.
Correct.
Okay. That's okay. Anything else? If not, I'll ask for comments from the public. Any individual wish to comment on this proposed ordinance? Okay, seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. And this opportunity for board deliberation, Commissioner Hall.
I'm ready to adopt.
All right, I would support that. As I said, we're not changing the way we do business.
So what do we do now, Jeff?
If you're prepared to do that today, we have an ordinance. The ordinance is in final form. You can make a motion to adopt ordinance number 400.
Are you comfortable with that, Commissioner?
I'm comfortable with that.
Again, the Planning Commission recommendation on this was unanimous, right?
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
And there hasn't been any other testimony at the Planning Commission to the contrary.
Yeah, but
no letters have come in.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt Ordinance 499, amending Lincoln County Comprehensive Plan and Land Use Code to update farm and forest provisions in Chapter 1.
I'll second that. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
That motion passes. All right.
We'll now
move on to our next public hearing, which is Ordinance Number 500 in the matter of an ordinance relating to land use planning, amending Ordinances Number 466, Number 473, and 477, and LCC 1.0108, and LCC 1.385, Bayshore Dune Management Plan and Ford Dune Management Overlay Zone, and declaring an emergency. And Board of Commissioners has initiated this legislative process by adopting Resolution Number 17-13-3B to initiate a code amendment process to consider boundary change in the management area subject to the Bayshore Dune Ford Dune Management Plan and Ford Dune Management Overlay Zone. The Planning Commission held a public hearing on September 25th, 2017, that has to be my daughter's birthday, and recommended an adoption of the amendments as proposed. This is a public hearing set before the Board of Commissioners to consider the Planning Commission's recommendations and to adopt an ordinance amending the Bayshore Plan and Lincoln County Code as recommended by the Planning Commission. The procedure is as follows, and probably will sound familiar. We'll have a public hearing. We'll have a staff report. We'll accept public testimony. We'll close the public hearing and have deliberation. So after that, if you're going to comment or testify today, we ask that you come forward to the table, give us your name and address for the record, and that you hand any materials over to our recorder, Christy Whitaker. And with that, I will ask Council Belmont to discuss the record and for Mr. Husing to give the staff report.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'd like to enter into the record case file number 2-TA-17, which is the Planning Commission file on this particular matter. And as in the last hearing, we have the proof of publication of the required notice for this particular ordinance. This is ordinance number 500. And I need to ask, is there any request by the commissioners that the ordinance be read in full?
No.
Hearing none, then I will read it by title only. Ordinance number 500 relating to land use planning, amending ordinances number 466, 473, 477, and LCC 1.0108. And LCC 1.1385, that's the Bayshore Dune Management Plan and the Ford Dune Management Overlay Zone, case file number 2-TA-17, and declaring an emergency. Turn it over to Mr. Husing.
Again, please.
Nice seeing you again, Hanno.
Yes. Seems like we just met.
I was going to say, don't be such a stranger.
It's been so long.
It's been so long. Seems like forever. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Hall, again, pleased to be here, and here we are amending our code. But unlike what we just did, this is actually discretionary. And there's some policy elements to this, so it's quite unlike what we just did. You have in your packet a memorandum which is a little more extensive, and I spent a lot more time on it than I would normally spend on writing a staff report, a memorandum relating to a code amendment. And the reason I did that was this is an opportunity now, literally a little over five years ago, we adopted the Bayshore Dune Management Plan in our code.
I remember that early in my tenure.
And I think one of the most memorable statements in the 5.5 years that I've been here, and we adopted this creature right after I got here. So all the preparation of the plan itself was really predated my arrival. When I came in, it was the 59th minute of the 11th hour on this process. And so when I sat in the same chair before you in August of 2012, quite memorably, Commissioner Hall, after I gave the staff report, took a deep breath and said, "Do you recall what you said?" He said, "Is this going to make things worse?"
Right.
And I didn't fully appreciate at that moment.
Can I give a little context
to where
I was asking that? But, you know, you and I are fellow historians, and looking at the history of human attempts to manage our coastline.
Or Mother Nature.
Yes, and Mother Nature. You know, that, you know, it's a very, very long history, but riprap and revetments, and so many times it seems like the best, you know, or stream bed management, you know, clear out the streams of the woody debris so salmon can navigate unimpeded, which we learned was really one of the worst things that, you know, my concern always is the interventions done with the best of intentions. Yep. Often can end up making things worse, and that was what I wanted to make sure. How
that
much
was behind what you
yeah,
your
exactly.
is, will this make that matters worse?
Yeah. Right, and knowing the challenges that Bayshore has faced in the 50 plus years since it was developed. So, back to you, sir.
Thank you for that. But yeah. I have quoted you so many mm-hmm. times mm-hmm. in the subsequent years, mm-hmm. and it was a profound question at the time. And I'm not sure I even answered it accurately. I said, "Oh no, this is going to make things better. This is a state of the art plan." And
mm-hmm.
now I stand behind.
If I may interject, I think it's always important to try to understand or anticipate unexpected consequences. And really, I think that's the nature of the question. What are we doing that may have implications down the road that maybe aren't expected or anticipated. So, go ahead.
And I remember being raked over the coals in a letter to the editor for having the temerity to say that we're going to manage that dune, because that was right, precisely what you're saying. Perhaps one of the most fluid, highly dynamic ecosystems on Earth are sand dunes and sand spits. And so the proposition that you're going to manage something that's fundamentally changes from moment to moment, especially during a big storm, is a daunting proposition, and that one letter to the editor was in effect calling me to task for making the assertion we could do that, was not completely terribly wide of the mark. However, if you have enough resources and the proper governance structures, we flew to the moon as human beings. Could we manage those dunes? Yes. With enough time and treasure and outstanding people being on the ground doing it. It can be done through sand fencing and bulldozers and planting vegetation so it traps the sand. And then like landscaping constantly going in. And, you know, it's not something you do once. You have to stay on it. So I stand by the proposition is absolutely you can manage a dune, but an awful lot of things, and then it won't make things perfect if you have a highly dynamic ecosystem down there. And I think it bears mentioning, if we had to do Bayshore all over again, I would make, and someone said, Mr. Husing, as a planning director, now we want to make this a residential area and in effect create a lot of residential property there. I would at least say, don't do it here. This the lower. So this is the peninsula. This is a schematic, and you have much better maps in your and there. And if the press needs better maps, be happy to get make sure they have it. But I don't think there's any doubt that that parts of the lower area in Bayshore should have never been developed. And I would never buy a place down there because the amount of sand and inundation that's happening down there is extraordinary. When people go down there, they're astonished that anyone actually wants to have a home there. But the prices for oceanfront real estate on the outer, this is Oceana here, the drive, on the outer side are so low because of these problems. I don't think there's anywhere else in the United States in the lower 48 where you could have the kind of, dollar per dollar. So people are drawn, because on a beautiful day, you have the bay right here and a Cape Perpetua. It's gorgeous down there. And I have made many friends in Bayshore, and they love being there. And their attitude is, well, no one made me buy this property. I'm here. So let's put that. But, I think it's really important because there are some people that will look at this it's good to get that behind us. Like, all right, perhaps it was a mistake in the first place. But this is the hand we're dealt.
That's right. You can't unring a bell, as retired Judge Huckleberry liked to say.
Right. So we're, in effect, so the proposition is, all right, can we then at least mitigate or manage the issue to make it somewhat tolerable? So in that spirit, there had been a... Let's go back to when the Bayshore Dune Management Plan was created in the first place. The decision was made to develop a management plan to try to at least tackle this issue. And for the most part, we've already been through three or four code... Yes, sir.
If I might clarify.
Please.
Wasn't part of the need to develop the management plan so that we were able to work with the state in an effort to address some of these issues, but to do that, we had to have a plan.
And it was another case of aligning all the FEMA responsibilities, the state agency, Goal 18 issues related to the state policies and beaches and dunes, our code. Yes, the proposition was, once we do this plan, there will be a set of measures, once implemented, that will be aligned. So if you get that permit from Lincoln County to carry out dune management, it'll have baked into that cake the federal and the state requirements there and trying to bring all this whole tangled web of different rules and regulations and state and federal laws related to that area so that when someone carried out a proposal, it would be, again, consistent with all of that. And then working, again, very closely with our friends and colleagues at Oregon State Parks because they have a very strong interest in their regulatory process. So as a practical matter, everything we do here, we're constantly interacting with our colleagues at the Department of Land Conservation and Development, DLCD, and Jay Sennewald, in particular, from Oregon State Parks, because you got to get permits to go on the beach to carry out some of these activities. So there's a tremendous amount of coordination, which I think serves the public well. We don't really make any moves here until... Then the plan sort of gets us in that direction. We make sure that we are discussing what we're doing with our colleagues at the state government as well, so that when we issue a permit, nobody's going to get a ticket because they didn't get the and that's the outcome, right? When you get a permit from us to do that, and we're all on board, people can go out there and not worry about, oops, now I'm crosswise with state parks, and they're looking to fine me because we did something on the beach that we weren't supposed to do. So yes, so thank you for bringing that up because it's a That was the good part of a lot of what we did with the Bayshore Dune Management Plan. It was meant to weave these things together into a seamless whole. Now, but there have been, we're on our third or fourth amendment to the Bayshore Dune Management Plan because we keep encountering impractical things. And that's good. I mean, that's not good, but it's good that we recognize that there's some things that need mending or need fixing, sort of, and the term... that I'm not fond of is called adaptive management, but it seems to be the great buzzword of the age, yeah. Right?
I mean, really, this was uncharted territory for us. It's not surprising, I would think, that, I mean, we didn't have something off the shelf to work with, and even if we did, the geography, the environment of Bayshore is unique. It shouldn't surprise us that we didn't get it perfect right out of the box.
Well, I would agree, Commissioner Hall, yeah. And it's not a failure that we're sitting. If anything, I've received some very positive feedback that we're potentially you're about to vote for this code amendment that I will talk about the specifics of in a minute after the history lesson.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much the other board members have been dialed in. I assume they have been, but you copy me in, citizens copy me in.
And you've been to many meetings with us in Bayshore.
Yeah,
you've taken strong interest.
I'd just like to get on the record. You know, certainly not everybody's happy. Some people, think sort of like that letter to the editor you mentioned, that, oh, how dare you think you could manage the environment, and other people would like to see us be much more aggressive, but the vast majority of Bayshore residents that I've encountered, dealt with, they appreciate the tremendous amount of time and energy you and your team, Wayne, has put in this, the state agencies, trying to come up with a workable solution to manage this problem. So I just want to get that out there for the public.
Thank you, and I do think that is the case. There was a time of 2 or 3 years ago where I was so deeply frustrated with what seemed to be any lack of progress and any lack of participation. Mm-hmm. And our colleagues in Bayshore, a lot of them don't even know each other. They're absentee owners, mm-hmm. trying to establish collective action, because the right. Dune plan sort of says, here's all the stuff, mm-hmm. now you got to get together and do it.
And
that was a huge flaw, yeah. and a shortcoming in the existing plan. It's largely the governance structure, because it anticipates that you're going to have a bunch of people then do all this stuff, yep. So we end up becoming like their consultants and having, and I don't mind doing it. That was the direction you gave to us. Try to make this better. There are a lot of properties in there. This is important that we try to make this better.
And another problem I'd just like to point out is for the people living below the dotted red line, it's a critical problem. These are the people whose houses are literally getting half buried some winters. But for the folks who live way up north near the highway, it's not so much of a problem, if at all. And so they aren't as motivated to want to contribute financially or otherwise to a solution. So, yeah, if everybody in Bayshore was linked arm in arm singing Kumbaya on this, it would be a lot easier.
And providing resources, yes. to do the management activities, uh-huh. that it takes. Correct. And you're right. That is a critical fissure within the, yeah. community. Is, yeah. if you have one part of the community that is directly impacted by this problem, mm-hmm. and two-thirds of Bayshore or more, it's probably much more than that, it isn't an issue.
Right.
So the loudest cries of, wait, every time the Bayshore Homeowners Association, for instance, has been petitioned, mm-hmm. to provide resources, mm-hmm. to do something about this, and even if they feel inclined, because of the public safety issues, to do something, mm-hmm. out of deep, mm-hmm. concern, mm-hmm. The blowback within Bayshore is, why are you bailing out the people? Let the people who have chosen to buy properties, many of them income properties, in fact, they don't even live here. They're vacation rentals.
Yep.
Why on earth are you asking us and our limited resource with the Homeowners Association to, in effect, underwrite them living in a place? That's their problem. Mm-hmm. And therein, Commissioner Hall, lies what has created this incredible vacuum, where the road district doesn't want to tackle these issues because they don't think it's part of their charter, and the Homeowners Association is sort of high-centered on this thing because every time they try to want to do something about it, they start having, again, the loudest cries come from within Bayshore,
yep.
that's inappropriate. So I agree, and I have said over and over again, and not hiding the ball here, that the answers lie within Bayshore, south of that schematic dotted line.
Yeah.
Where the people that are impacted need to step up and be part of this and make this work.
Yeah, and then when we sit at some of those meetings and nearby first responders tell us that they're worried that somebody's going to die because a road is impassable and they won't be able to get an ambulance in, and looks around the room looking for somebody to step up and say, okay, we're going to fix it, and if people can't see that, again, I think for some of the reasons you've just outlined, Mr. Husing, It's been challenging, and so I want to say again, kudos for the persistence in working with the community, acknowledging the differing interests and priorities, and trying to craft solutions that work.
So what are we trying to do?
Yes, yeah, that's enough. I'm sure
this is all
you and I could go
on.
And I appreciate that, because we've set the context now for the overall.
Because I'm thinking people watching are going to wonder, why is this so
What are we doing here today?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get to the heart of the matter.
Yes.
When the Bayshore Dune Management Plan was created, a fateful decision was made that... And I should say that back in the old, what I'm sure for many people in Bayshore would be considered the good old days. And by the way, this is something that people in Bayshore have been saying to us for 5 years, is why on earth is this, did you create the plan in the way that I'm about to describe, and would you please change it? So there is tremendous support within Bayshore for us to do what we're about to do. But here's, Commissioner Hunt, here's what we're doing. So when the plan was adopted for this, especially for this challenging area on the south end, the management plan boundary is on the, so you have the, here's, you know, the roadway is here, right? Let's, all right, that's the asphalt on Northwest Oceana. And then on either side, there's a 60 foot right of way. So this is the entire right of way. This is Oceana itself. And so the houses are here, but the property lines start here. So that's a close up of what I'm going to describe here. So the management line further north on the northern part of Bayshore, where there's less inundation, is on the western side of the road, the ocean side of the road, at the right of way, not the asphalt, at the right of way where people's property starts. But then when it gets down to where the issues really start, because, yes, there's more sand there. The consultant at the time, and what we built into the plan was the management area leaps on, so this is what we're going to change. It makes this 90-degree turn and goes to the right-of-way over here and encompasses the right-of-way. So all of this area here, including Northwest Oceana, lies within the management system. So what does that mean? What that means is, to clear sand off the roadway, you need to get permits from the county, and then, which is, has its own logistical issues, and then there is an affirmative responsibility to return that sand to the beach, because under Goal 18, beach sand is a resource, and really Goal 18, not the riprap part of it, but the beach and dune part, or the dune part of it, was to make, there had been commercial mining of beach sand on the Oregon coast. A lot of our cities years ago, the contracted communities went down to the beach and loaded up a bunch of trucks full of sand and used it for fill. And it's great fill, because it has no organic material in them. It's great stuff. So that was a practice. And absolutely, that kind of practice at a large scale would begin to, you know, potentially create this imbalance here, where the beach sand is also a problem, but it's also protecting, so if you take too much of that away, you're going to hit some point of inflection. And it begs the question, how much material can you move before it's a problem? But in recognition of that, that was the heart and soul of Goal 18, was one of the things was to stop the beach mining from happening. And so the consultant went ahead and it wasn't a crazy idea, because there's an awful lot of sand here. So where the system is, but we, you know, in the memo I pointed out, there's, every time I ask a geologist with the correct credentials, where would the appropriate place for the line be, I get a different answer.
So in other words, there's some science to it, but there's also a degree of art. Would you say that's fair to say?
Well,
interpretation maybe of science?
And the sentence within the memorandum that I spent the most time brooding about and rewriting and writing and rewriting was that, in talking with one of our colleagues, because it's like how much of this is science and how much of this is policy? Mm-hmm. Especially when the science is all over the map, that every time you ask someone who has the right credentials, they come up with a wildly different answer. Entirely plausible that they would have a different answer. This is a fundamentally dynamic system.
Right.
So the idea that you're going to fix a line on something that's like a fire hose that's doing that. Yeah. Right there is a challenge, as you know, it was in the memo.
A line in the sand.
So a line in the shifting sands.
Yes.
That's meant to say this is the end of the system.
Yep.
And we're talking about one very qualified consultant thinks that the line ought to be way up past where the port is. Mm. Yeah, and there was another member of the science, of the community with the right skill sets thought that because there's riprap out in front of these houses that the line ought to be here because that beach is not going to retreat past that riprap as long as the riprap is there. And so, you know, this should not be deemed a sacrosanct, but the key point that was made by one informed individual said, Anno, you need to understand that the line under the dune management plan on the land use system is a regulatory construct. That's the term. It's not a scientific call. And we actually get to make that. We have to make this practical. And I think we're honoring, you know, when we talked about, so what we want to do is basically what one person said, this was a 60-foot mistake.
Mm-hmm.
What we should have done is it should not have come over here, because here's the bottom line. In the past, the local contracting community would clean up the road for free.
Mm-hmm.
They would come in and gather up the material, a triag, and they would stockpile the material further up the bay because they used it as a resource for development purposes. And everybody loved that. Well, for free, you got the road clear. Now, when we did this, Commissioner Hall, did we make things worse? In the community, they would say, absolutely we made things worse because you put the line over there and now we got to spend thousands and thousands of dollars of heaping up, bringing the sand over there with all the time and the permits and the issues. They wanted to go back to the good old days of being able to just clean off this road, especially for public safety purposes.
And essentially, this is what we'll doing right. this will allow.
So
right?
when we amend this, the line this hops to the other side, and now the materials can be removed. One other point, I'm sure you're probably going there already too, is now I want to offer that Jay Sennewald from Oregon State Parks, he was an instrumental figure in this because he realized that the other unintended consequence of taking this material and putting it back on the beach is that an awful lot of gravel and asphalt ended up on the beach. And so our colleagues at State Parks, Jay is saying, wait a minute, I got an OAR that prohibits that.
Yeah.
And we got an OAR that says you got to bring it to the beach. So there are these dueling OARs. So again, this was really a nod to practicality. We keep trying to fix this thing. And, you know, the other thing that I did that was a suggestion by Jay Sennewald as well was I made sure I made some phone calls to some key interest groups that have a strong interest in Goal 18. You and I, of course, talked about that. Because we wanted to make sure, and we don't have any opponents here today. We haven't had any letters, and that's not an accident.
I was going to say, that is extremely telling. The absence is...
Right. Well, the fact that... Well, I think our colleagues in Bayshore believe this is kind of a done deal, and so they're not in the room saying, oh my God, there are some letters and things in support of this, of course, and the community is wildly in support of this. In fact, I got a lot of guff when I said, I think we're comfortable, ready to go forward this. They said, why did it take you 5 years to finally do this thing? I mean, that was really some of the response. It wasn't like, hooray, it was, got it. Well, you know, it took you long enough to finally get your you-know-what out of your you-know-what. So the point is, we did interact with key members of the conservation community to walk them through what we were doing. And we did that out of courtesy. We didn't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we did it out of courtesy because I wanted to make sure, because they care so deeply about Goal 18, and Goal 18 is important. What we wanted to make sure was that they understood what we were thinking about doing, get their feedback early in the process, so that they understood that it was our intent not to erode Goal 18. That we weren't a bunch of knuckleheads out there that didn't care about the environment and didn't do this and do that. We were just responding to the needs of the property owners, and we were throwing caution to the wind and doing this. I wanted them to really understand that we had thought deeply about this. We had state agencies understanding what was going on. We had dueling OARs. And that the amount of material, frankly, that would be removed is between 5,000 to 10,000 cubic yards a year. If I had to guess, if they just go ahead back to the good old days and remove that, that isn't a grain of sand on the beach. I purposely didn't put it in the memo how many millions or tens of millions of cubic yards are part. The system goes 10-15 miles offshore, mm-hmm. goes underwater south past Coos Bay. This is a the amount of sand we're talking about, and the amount of that's part of the system, and the amount of sand that we're talking about no longer being part of the system is de minimis. And I feel comfortable saying that.
Which is a fancy word for tiny, right? Or almost negligible or not.
Well, a drop in the bucket, a grain of sand. And you know, it's interesting when you, because if you wanted a hard and fast answer, and of course we engaged some people in the scientific community and said, what would it take to get a definitive answer whether 5 or 10,000 cubic yards is okay to take? Mm-hmm. And I could tell when I would ask them that question, they sort of act, that's kind of like an asking a doctor, like, all right, how many cigarettes per month could you smoke, and it's not going to impact your health? Yeah. Well, no one quite knows, but right. the more you do, And the answer would have taken like 5 years and $250,000 of modeling, and you still wouldn't have gotten some kind of firm answer. But I don't think we're anywhere close to the cliff's edge here to allow for that amount of material, especially since it's tainted with these other materials. We don't want it back on the beach, to get it out of there. The other thing that isn't in the memo that I think is important is the memo did try to focus on some of the good things that are beginning to happen in Bayshore, because I also communicated with our colleagues in the conservation community that the county and the state had cracked down on practice in Bayshore of just grading the dunes without the proper permits. And we were hoping to create pilot projects where people could work with the dune plan to go forward and make some of these good changes, but it just wasn't happening, and people were just bulldozing dunes largely to get their view back. Because it makes a big difference financially, especially for vacation rentals, if you have the view or not. And so I understand their motivation to grade the dunes flat, but it was making the situation even more comical and counterproductive. So it was over a year and a half to almost 2 years ago now that we basically, with state parks really leading it, I was already there saying, we've got to crack down on the illegal dune grading that's happening. And there were other celebrated examples up and down the Oregon coast where the same thing was happening. And state parks was really coming in and fining. I mean, they have an ability to step in and start writing tickets right away. That's really quite amazing what their enforcement powers are. But this whole issue had flipped. The state was now cracking down, not on Bayshore yet. They would have if they saw what was going on, but further north. So that change was in the wind. And when Jay came on board and we looked at the circumstances, obviously the planets aligned. To begin, the agencies were there, and then we needed to bring members of the community was always there on moving the line, but now the agencies were there, and in the courtesy interactions with members of the conservation community, not everybody I spoke to thought it was a good idea, but so I don't want to mislead people by saying everyone I spoke to in the conservation community embraced it, but they're not here today.
There's a consensus
that this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But I don't want to say that every single person
embraces it.
But this is close to what would be a true consensus that this would be it's a modest step, mm-hmm. makes the plan more practical. And I think the other thing that I've been told by some of the leaders down in Bayshore is that it's very hard to have conversations with their neighbors about engaging in and providing the resources for the real management, as long as in their minds this crazy nonsense about not allowing the road to be cleared up was there. Okay. So I think there'll be a psychological breakthrough if we adopt this code amendment to help us keep moving toward the positive management aspects, that the good parts of the plan that are entirely consistent with Goal 18. Okay. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will stand down unless you have further questions.
Commissioner,
I don't.
I have no questions at this point. So I'll move to accept public testimony. Anyone wish to provide comments or testimony? Seeing nobody come forward, I will close the public hearing. And any other questions? Or
Mr. Belmont, what's our next step?
Well, let me describe what the ordinance itself does. It's a little bit unusual. This is actually the third amendment that we've made to the Bayshore plan. So the ordinance that's prepared for this would, one, describe the new boundaries. And basically, it's a fairly simple description. It moves it from the west right-of-way line to the east, or excuse me, make sure.
All the way around.
Yeah, it's now the...
Moves it from west to east.
Yeah,
no,
moves
east, east to west.
East to west.
As indicated up there. So that language is inside the code. That's number one. Yeah, yeah. Number two, it says, notwithstanding, and because there's a lot of references to the plan boundaries and things within the management plan itself, that we say, notwithstanding anything else that's in that plan, this is the new boundary. That's number two. Number three, we're directing our GIS department to actually prepare a new official map for this so that we have a physical depiction of where the new boundary is, and that'll be available for use by planning and by others. And then number four is that when we amend the code, we'll add a note that reflects this inside the code itself. That reflects that there is a new boundary, so that's not missed.
Okay. Any questions or comments?
No. I'm ready to move forward, Mr. Chair, if you are.
Right. Well, I would just say that I think it's been pretty well documented that, you know, this isn't necessarily the perfect solution to a challenging situation, but it's certainly one that seems to be practical and reasonable and workable, and certainly in the best interest of most of the people, I think, that are involved. So
I would agree.
I certainly support the ordinance.
So do we move it for
motion
adoption?
Move it to adopt ordinance number 500.
We cannot adopt it today? We don't have another hearing?
Nope.
Okay.
Same as the prior ordinance.
Right. Okay. Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt ordinance number 500 relating to land use planning, amending ordinances 466, 473, and 477, and LCC 1.0108, and LCC 1.385, Bayshore Dune Management Plan, and Four Dune Management Overlay Zone, and declaring an emergency.
And I'll second that. Any other discussion or comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that action, members of the commission, it is now lawful to remove at this moment, since you just took that vote and you adopted the ordinance.
Go with an emergency.
They can now move sand as of this moment.
All right.
So
all
right.
Because I wanted to make sure, because there will be people be moving sand today, because that's the expectation.
Go back to your office, pick up the phone, and tell them pound sand.
And with that, we'll move along.
Yes. Most people are insulted if you tell them to go pound sand, but I expect to be hearing distant cheers from the south.
I can hardly look forward to the next time I get to conduct one of these meetings. Good work.
Okay, next item on our agenda is reports, and we have a report from the sheriff, and we'll be discussing the new strategic plan.
And can I say, sheriff and team, thank you for being here, and thank you for your patience during our wrestling with these land use matters. The Bayshore one in particular is kind of complicated, and I thought it important that people understand the context of what we were doing and why we were doing it. So
no problem. Our deputies definitely know the area down there.
The
sand and driving through, and
I've driven it many a times, and even though I have an SUV, I'm kind of I don't know. There's a lot of sand down there. Can I get through it?
So. Did you work out of Walport at one point? Do I remember or not?
Well, I worked South County. I never worked for Walport. No,
but you spent time.
Yeah,
it can be surrealistic when you're down there. It's like in a different world.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Anyhow, go ahead.
Thanks.
No more about the sand. And good morning, commissioners. Thank you for having me. I am Curtis Landers, Lincoln County Sheriff, and I wanted to present to you our new strategic plan for the years 2017 to 2020. And you may ask, four years, why 4 years? And as elected officials, you probably kind of get the meaning of the 4 years over a typical 5 or 10 year strategic plan, as a lot of companies or organizations may put together. I chose the 4 year plan just because it falls in line with the terms of the election. And several of our leadership team that helped create the plan are in the audience today. And we didn't hire anybody to help us with this. We had a previous strategic plan under Sheriff Dotson, and we kind of took components of that we liked, and we wanted to make it a kind of refreshed and move to the future of where we wanted to go. And I think the one of the key elements that we did decide to do from the last plan is we basically had individualized goals and objectives for each division in the sheriff's office, and we basically combined it into one set of goals and objectives overall for the sheriff's office. As we move forward and present those, what will happen each January is the division commanders will meet with their teams and come up with action items that they want to do in the coming year that corresponds with the objectives and goals of the plan. And so that will be specific for each division, but the goals and objectives will be overall for the sheriff's office. You should have a copy in your packet. I don't know how well you can see it up here on the screen, but you can follow along in however you choose. So it is kind of hard to see the writing up there, so you do have it in there. Again, we developed it over the last few months. We wanted to set priorities, focus our energy and resources, and strengthen our operations. It's very important, I think, for an organization to have a direction where we want to go. And what a strategic plan basically does is provide a roadmap for our members to know where we're heading and where we want to go in the organization. And I think that's important to move to the future. In law enforcement, I think there's a lot of things that have remained the same over the years, over my 30 years in there, but there are more things that have changed, and I think that's important to realize that a lot of things have changed over time, and we'll talk about a little bit more for those. So basically, we took two guiding principles in the plan. We took the final report of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, and our mission statement, which I'll talk about a little bit later, that we updated and revised. I think the 21st Century Policing Plan, you've heard me talk about that, is very important. There's six individual pillars that I'll mention here in a second. If you haven't read the document, I encourage you to at least read the executive summary. It talks about these six pillars, how they came about, and why it's so important that I think law enforcement organizations adopt those as far as where they want to go. I think one important thing is embracing a guardian over a warrior mindset. Previous years, we used to have that warrior mindset, and I think the guardian mindset established procedural justice of the culture of the agency to formulate the idea of fairness in our processes. And I think that's really important that guardian thing is presented out there, and all of our members do know that. I think as we plan for the future, we recognize the importance of accountability to our citizens, criminal justice system, and to each other. And our accountability is outlined in the four goals that we've defined in our plan, which is enhance employee safety, growth, and retention, embrace and integrate technology, improve safety and quality of life for our community and visitors, and achieve organizational excellence, earn public trust, and provide superior service. And I think with these goals in mind, our team will focus on efficient delivery, a quality service, embracing evidence-based practices, increasing safety for our team members, and building partnerships throughout our community. Talked about our mission statement, and as you see up there, mission statement, it's not a drastic change from what it used to be. We took several elements and just kind of condensed it down to something, and I think it's important that we make it impactful and memorable, I think, are two things we want to do. We want our members to know it. And basically, it's enhance public safety, reduce the fear and impact of crime, and improve quality of life. And I think those really hit the point, what we're trying to do. Overall, as a sheriff's office, public safety is definitely number one. It's one thing we're striving for. But I think reducing impact and fear of crime is... and the impact of crime, I think, is more important than even the fear that we previously had. And there is the fact that it's what does crime do to society? And even if you're not specifically targeted or you haven't been impacted by crime, I think overall in the community at some point it does impact you. And I think improved quality of life. I think when you take in, we have emergency management, our animal shelter, the jail, our support services, and our patrol division, I think all that goes to quality of life and what we do for our citizens and making it better. Again, I talked about how law enforcement's changed over the years, and it's a lot of services that we provide now that we didn't do in the past, and I think it's those things that the citizens want us to do. With that at the bottom there, you'll see the pillars of the 21st Century Policing Report. Between the mission statement and those pillars, this is how we identified our goals and objectives. And those pillars are building trust and legitimacy, policy and oversight, technology and social media, community policing and crime reduction, an Office of Wellness and Safety. And we'll move on here, talk about each one of those here a little bit. First goal is to enhance employee safety, growth, and retention. I think, as we know, not only in law enforcement, but even in government, retaining and finding employees is a number one concern right now. It's something that we didn't experience in the, you know, several years ago. We had several people that applied for our jobs, and it's something we didn't, that was probably never looked at or even thought would be having to be considered in a strategic plan. But I think it's growth and retention of our is something that we have to do. And I think we have to ensure that our employee safety is first priority. Law enforcement's dangerous, and I think employee safety needs to be number one. Improve quality of life and wellness for them. Continue their training and education and inspire growth, I think, is very important. And a lot of things we hear is they want to continue training, they want to learn more, they want to develop in their profession and also in their personal growth. And so I think that's very important to continue to do that. I think we do a good job. Participate in ongoing succession planning to ensure successful leadership transition. I think another very important point to that is the fact that and we have succession planning for the county, as you know, and within our organization. I think when we went through this last change, when Sheriff Dotson left and I moved in that position, we had Lieutenant Carey out of the patrol division, we had a couple new lieutenants, several new sergeants, myself were all new, and I think that that succession planning has helped for as smooth as transition as can be into a new era. And I think that's important. If we wouldn't have had that succession planning and training in place, that wouldn't happen, and we need to continue that. It also goes back to that growth and inspiring growth. People know that they can inspire to, if they have goals of moving on, that will provide them with that experience to do that. Promote and encourage diversity within our membership. Again, this is right out of the 21st century policing as far as diversity in a workforce, specifically with law enforcement. Maintain high recruitment standards. I think finding people was one thing, but we can't reduce what we're doing as far as recruitment standards. We still, there's several studies that went on over the years back in the 70s where people lowered their standards, and, you know, it's a road to a bad outcome. And define and promote the professional image of the sheriff's office, something we always do. It's a law enforcement a thing that I think is very important that we do. Again, as you see in the picture up there with our honor guard, it's a professional image that the sheriff's office is accustomed to. The next goal is embrace and integrate technology. Again, that's something that you probably wouldn't have heard of in a long time ago, 30, 40 years ago. But technology is always changing. It's always improving what we do, our efficiencies, our safety. And we have to really embrace and integrate that. Change is going to happen, and we just need to make sure that we're ready to do that. So our objectives in that are identify solutions to improve efficiencies and higher quality services. Seek and utilize available technological advances. Utilize social media to keep our citizens informed and promote the sheriff's office. That kind of comes under another goal and objective that we talk about, that we'll talk about later with transparency. But social media is definitely a technology part of that piece. And increase technological and training opportunities for professional development. The next goal we have is improve safety and quality of life. Again, talked about with our mission statement and the 21st century policing. The objectives there, research and identify evidence-based alternatives and programs for reducing crimes. You hear with our partners, with the district attorney's office, with the community justice things we're doing with justice reinvestment programs, stepping up initiative that Commissioner Hall is very active in. All those things we're looking at reducing that crime and trying to reduce the need for the number of beds we have in our jail. I think it's important, and not to have to build further jail beds, because we know building more jail beds isn't working, and you've heard that from me before. Make partnerships and relationships a priority. That is so important to me, and what I've known for a long time as far as let's get a catch up here on the slides here I've been looking through. Partnerships and relationships are so important, again, just to what we do. You know that. I appreciate the relationships I have with the commissioners, and I hope that it's reciprocated with you. But it goes beyond that with everything that we do, and it's one thing that I really encourage with our members. encourage citizen involvement. You know, we're starting a community group that we're going to advisor group that we're going to have here. It's looking like it's going to be January. We actually received a lot more interest than I actually originally anticipated. I thought actually I'd have to be going out looking for people myself, and people came to us, which I'm very thankful for. So yeah. It's good to have that problem.
Nice problem to have.
Yes, exactly. And narrow that group down to about 12 individuals. I'm going to meet with all of them individually and hear a little bit more why they want to be here, and so they can hear a little bit more what we expect to get out of it. But again, in getting that involvement, again, look at that transparency piece of it. I think it's going to be very important. A lot of people have told me that I can't believe that you've had the guts to do it and the courage. And I, you know, it's something that I want to do. I don't, guts and courage really never entered into the equation of it because of what I believe in and the transparency of our office. I think is so important. We just want another method to get our word out there, and we really want to hear from the citizens to know what they want. And because I think that's so important to drive, so we can again give them that quality of life that they want. And there are certain things that are priorities in law enforcement that we all know that we respond to, but there's a lot of things that we can do based on what the citizens want in the community. Again, encourage community and joint problem solving for crime prevention. Another piece of that, we try to meet with as many groups as we can. Sluts is a great example of that what we have done up there in a little over a year's time that we've been able to be out there. Remain available and accessible to all community members, and enhance awareness and response to mental health, which again has been a problem, you know, with the Stepping Up initiative. Again, another priority that I'm working on. Moving on to the next goal, achieve organizational excellence, earn public trust, and provide superior service. Again, build that 21st century policing culture is so important. Maintain fiscal efficiencies, protect resources and budget to achieve identified goals. I think, again, it's important we have that precious tax dollar coming in, that we have a lot of work to do. We want to make sure that we are using it wisely and to the best that we can. While we try not to let the budget drive us, we want our mission statement and our strategic plan drive it. We still have to be aware of what that the funding is. We need to continue to review and enhance policies to meet best law enforcement practices. Again, another part of the pillars. Constantly, you know, looking at our policies to provide best practices. We subscribe with Lexapol, as you know, that allows us to do that. The jail is actually going through that process to carry that over to the jail standards that they have in the jail right now. So we'll be completely under Lexapol office-wide, which I think is so important because of the updates that come in from their legal ability and just the fact that they're keeping up on everything that's happening with case law, best practices, and law enforcement. So it's good to maintain that. Maintain accreditation. We just recently this year passed our first accreditation, and we want to maintain that on a three-year cycle, and we'll be doing that. Again, that comes back to providing those best practices, not just indicating that you have a policy, but showing that you're actually following the policy that you have. Again, recognize and embrace diversity, not only in membership, but within our community, and I think that's so important. And promote an open and transparent environment. Again, we talked about the transparency is the last one on here in the objectives, but it kind of falls in everything that we do. We're really trying to get the message out on social media. We try to get our media releases. You know, I grew up in an environment within the sheriff's office, and it just wasn't because of the leadership here, but it was public safety in general that you were taught to be scared of the media, don't talk to them. Only the sheriff talked to them, and that's not like how it is here. Our members put out our media releases. Our members put their own names. The media is free to talk to the members to gain information about a case. It makes more sense for them to hear it right from the person who handled the case than someone like myself. It doesn't mean in big events that I don't come out and speak for the office, which is always important, as you know. But on individual, just getting the message out, I think it's so important.
As an old reporter, may I say thank you for that personally, too. I can remember long before you were in charge, or Sheriff Dotson, when I was still a radio reporter, and like, for instance, there would be an injury crash where LCSO had been lead in responding, and my boss would say to me, well, why did it take 4 days to have anything about that accident on the air? And I said, because... Well, they told me I could only talk to the sheriff or undersheriff, and neither of them were available
Then. So. And in this day and age with social media and how the word gets out, if you don't put out the message, it's going to get put out by somebody else. And so you want to make sure the message is going out correctly.
Correctly. Mr. Card would agree, too. Information of, you know, abhors a vacuum, and how many times would I get a call about an accident and say, oh, gee, I saw this terrible accident on Otter Crest just... two cars ripped apart. I'm sure somebody was killed. And then, you know, luckily, I think because of improved safety technology, when I would get the information from LCSO or state police, you know, it would turn out often that minimal injuries. But, you know, it's sad that even the rumor mill, and even when the good information is out there, sometimes the rumor mill goes nuts. But yeah, being timely and proactive in getting information out, it's wonderful.
And it's still difficult, because when an incident's happening, like I said, with the times that we're in right now, things are rapidly evolving, and a lot of times the deputy needs to, you know, the first function, sure, is the job at hand,
exactly,
even though we want to get that word, yes, out. So we struggle with that, because all of a sudden, yep, it's all over social media,
sure,
and then we get the message out. But
sure,
we still try our best to do that, but we're you know, our members aren't afraid to talk to the media.
Appreciate
now,
that. Yeah,
that's
that,
the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Another old war story is, I can remember there was some kind of incident happening where the Coast Guard was responding, something very close offshore in Newport, and people were calling me at the radio station saying, well, why aren't you letting us know what's going on out there? And I said, well, because literally the Coast Guard is still in the, yes, middle of their response, and there's, yeah, nobody that can talk. So,
and you know, yeah, sometimes there's scenes or mm-hmm, incidents that we just can't release information.
Sure.
And I think being as transparent as we are, I think the media understands that. I hope the media understands that there's just some things that we can't, and if we can't, we tell them, and,
yeah,
and we'll,
yeah,
try to get information when we can. So so that's our strategic plan for the upcoming years in kind of a nutshell. We didn't fill with a lot of statistics. We tried to put out, we will be putting out an annual report about basically statistics and what's happened, but I wanted this to be a basic roadmap so that's easy to follow and our members know what we're trying to achieve.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I really don't have any questions, more just a few comments. I think because of a couple of things, the great communication you have maintained with us, and also the fact that I see this as truly an evolutionary rather than revolutionary document, that it's just continuing, amplifying paths that the Sheriff's Office has been on in a long time. There's nothing in here that really surprises me, and everything in here truly pleases me. I mean, I my hat's off to you, to the rest of your team here, and all the folks who are not here out in the field for continuing a commitment to excellent public service and responsive public service. And I would encourage, is this on your webpage yet?
Yeah.
Okay, encourage the public to go to the website and look at this document, and if you're interested in learning more what the Sheriff's Office is all about.
Thank you.
No, I think it's a great document, and I would add that as I listened to your comments, I heard a couple of themes that I think are certainly valuable and themes that can be applied to the entire county, if you will. And certainly, you're looking at hiring and retaining the best individuals. You're providing opportunity for growth and development. You're operating transparently and really trying to create an environment of empowerment of your employees. So I think those are all great aspects of the strategic plan that have value throughout the county. So good work.
Thank you very much. And again, I'm up here presenting it, but I can't take all the credit. In fact, most of the credit.
Would you please recognize the individuals in the audience?
Yes,
please.
We have Lisa Holmes, our Support Services Director. Lieutenant Jamie Russell, our Jail Commander. Lieutenant Adam Shanks, our Administrative Lieutenant. Lieutenant Brian Cameron, our Patrol Commander. That's Roy.
Roy's not. Gainer. Roy has a run over there. You're out of uniform,
Ryan, right back there.
I'm sorry. Who's the last
and
lady?
Sergeant Marie Gainer, one of our correction sergeants.
We know Marie, but I wanted, yes, to make sure she got recognized.
Yeah, absolutely. And
thanks
all. Great
for
work
being
that
here.
They did to put into this, and we look forward to the next upcoming years.
Well, again, I think a good demonstration of it's a team effort. So,
absolutely.
Last thing I'd say is, I understand we have our annual jail tour coming up
tomorrow.
Tomorrow morning. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's coming quickly.
Yes. Yes. I look forward to that. So, look forward to seeing you.
All right,
Commissioners, maybe you could, I don't know if it's too premature to make the announcement of one of your community involvement activities you're doing, because you're going to see officers around. deputies around in the month of November. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, today's November 1st, and we are doing a No Shave November, which a lot of people may participate in No Shave November. It's kind of impactful for us because our policy doesn't allow us to grow beards for the uniform members. And so this allows them to grow a beard. It's in the effort of supporting cancer awareness and cancer and donation. We actually have a website set up that you can go to, I believe from our website, is that right, that you can, or Facebook page where you can go and donate if you wish.
All right.
But it'll be a fun event for our deputies because they're usually not allowed to grow the beards, and so I know they've been looking forward to November coming so they can kind of let it grow. We'll look a little, little straggly in the community for a little bit, but it's for a good cause.
Exactly.
We just completed breast cancer awareness. We probably saw the pink undershirts that we were wearing awareness of breast cancer awareness. So again, basically both two good programs to support and adds a little fun to our members and what they want.
Keep up the good work, ladies and gentlemen.
There's some other activities.
How about the lemonade challenge?
Yeah, we did that over the summer.
Where,
again, you probably saw a picture of there about the that was the one of the lemonade stand challenges where it took off on social media a lot larger than we ever thought it would, but we basically said that we'd have a deputy or one or more attend every lemonade stand in the county and benefit the young entrepreneurs in their endeavor. And I think it encouraged kids to go outside and set up lemonade stands because I think that we had a lot more lemonade stands than we ever thought we would.
Cool.
And I think it's because we did this challenge. And so we're going to make that an annual event. It was one of those ones we just finally had to cut off because we were getting calls for lemonade stands and calls for service, and deputies really wanted to make sure that since we made it a priority to attend those, that we did. And so it was great. It was fun. I attended a couple myself, and it was really good.
Good. Excellent.
Good work.
Yeah. Thank you all.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great report. Next we have commissioner reports. Commissioner Hall.
I'm going to pass.
And I will pass. Next would be constituent input. Any individual wishes to comment, you may comment on any item and use up to 5 minutes, seeing no one come forward. I will announce that our next Board of Commissioners meeting will be Wednesday, November 8th at 9:30 p.m. right here in the Lincoln County
Chair,
Courthouse.
No, it will be 9:30 a.m.
I did say
you did.
Well, and in my defense,
is there a typo there?
There is a typo. So
yeah, I just didn't want the public showing up and pounding on the door.
Yeah,
saying like, what was that old department store commercial where open? No, not Hobby Dog.
Okay, so it will be Wednesday, November 8th at 9:30 a.m.
Yes.
And while we're talking about meetings, I'll note that our November 15th meeting is canceled because all three of us will be attending the annual Association of Oregon Counties Conference in Eugene, and I believe that will be your last official act as president of that organization.
That's correct. Having
served for a year.
Yep, and I'll be taking part in at least a couple of panels. I don't know about the full schedule yet, but I will be moderating a panel with Commissioner Thompson and also Dee Pigsley, the chair of the Confederated Tribes of the Sletts, talking about county-tribal relations. And then also our veteran service officer, Devin Whitaker, and I will be joining Mitch Sparks, who is the number two man in Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And once again, they consider the relationship between our county commission and our local veteran service office model that they want to encourage other counties to emulate. And so the three of us will be up there 45 minutes talking about that and answering questions.
And I'll be moderating a panel on the maritime industry sector strategies. So.
Which is what you are leading with that effort is huge, getting a vital section of our economy that it's there, it's providing jobs, but yet the state modeling doesn't recognize it, and thank you for your leadership on that effort.
Thank you.
It makes a big difference.
It's an interesting journey with some distance to go, but we're making progress.
Okay.
So with that, we are adjourned.